and a good Thursday morning to you. Welcome into the Nick Craig Show, streaming live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, and X. You can also listen 24/7 on your favorite podcast app by checking out the Nick Craig Show. You can also listen online by visiting the website nickcraig.com. Our show this morning is brought to you in part by The Law Group. Check them out at lawgroupnc.com or give them a call at 910-251-6088. We've got a jam-packed Thursday edition for you this morning. Thanks for spending part of it with us as we begin with some very interesting international news this morning as Israel appears to be preparing to launch an attack soon against Iran. That's according to officials in the United States and Europe being exclusively reported by the New York Times this morning, a step that could further inflame the Middle East and derail or delay efforts by the Trump administration to broker a deal to cut off Iran's path to building a nuclear bomb. The concern about a potential Israeli strike and the prospect of retaliations by Iran has led the United States on Wednesday to withdraw diplomats from Iraq and authorize the voluntary departure of U.S. military family members from the Middle East. Now, I do want to state, and it's pointed out in the New York Times post, that it's unclear exactly how large or how severe an attack Israel might be preparing. That it does remain unknown this morning, but the rising tensions, of course, is the big concern. This comes after months in which Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel has pressed President Trump to seize on what Israel sees as a moment of Iranian vulnerability to strike. Trump waved off another plan by Israel several months ago to attack Iran, insisting that he wanted a chance to negotiate a deal with Tehran that would choke off Iran's ability to produce more nuclear fuel for a bomb. 2 weeks ago, President Trump said that he had warned Benjamin Netanyahu about launching a strike while the U.S. negotiates with Iran and while that continues to be underway. It's not immediately clear as of right now how much effort the president made to block Netanyahu's attempts again this time, but the president has appeared less optimistic in recent days about the prospect of a diplomatic settlement after Iran's supreme leader rejected an administration proposal that would have effectively phased out Iran's ability to enrich uranium on its soil. Obviously, the enriching of uranium is what can lead to the nuclear warheads, any sort of nuclear sort of bomb or armament. Benjamin Netanyahu has walked up to bombing Iran's nuclear facilities in the past, only to back off at the last minute. So this is going to be a very interesting thing to follow. It's the idea here that an attack seems relatively imminent because the fact that the United States is removing diplomats from portions of Iraq, are telling other individuals in the Middle East to, hey, voluntarily, if you want to leave, this is your chance to do so. President Trump last night in Florida was asked by reporters about military personnel being evacuated from the Middle East. Here was that exchange.
U.S. dependents of military personnel being authorized to leave the Middle East? We'll have to say thank you.
So he says the question, why are U.S. Dependents of military personnel being evacuated from the Middle East? The president's response, you'll have to see. Thank you. So again, here you've got multiple things that are kind of lining up. A bunch of things that seem maybe coincidental, all lining up, adding some pretty significant leverage to the fact that there is an attack imminent as it stands this morning. Word of the U.S. decision to withdraw personnel from the region, along with a warning from Britain about new threats to Middle East commercial shipping, came hours after President Donald Trump told the New York Post in a podcast that he had grown less confident about the prospects for a deal with Iran that would limit its ability to develop nuclear weapons. American and Iranian negotiators have been planning to meet on Sunday for another round of talks, although President Trump told reporters on Monday that Iran had adopted an unacceptable negotiating position. As of yesterday, the president's envoy to the talks, Steve Witkoff, was still planning to attend the negotiations in Oman, in the Middle East, again, coming up on Sunday. You can probably imagine, and I don't think it's too far of a stretch to say, those talks might permanently be on hold, depending on what happens in the next couple of days. Asked about the reason for the departure of U.S. personnel and dependents from the region as he arrived at the Kennedy Center in Washington for a Wednesday evening performance, President Trump told reporters, "Well, you're going to have to figure that one out yourself." The British warning came from a maritime trade agency that monitors Middle East shipping and that said in a public advisory that it has, quote, been made aware of an increased tension within the region, which could lead to an escalation of military activity having a direct impact on mariners. The advisory urges commercial vessels transitioning the Persian Gulf, the Gulf of Oman, and the Strait of Hormuz to use a heightened caution. Iranian military and government officials have already met to discuss their response to a potential attack from Israel, according to a senior Iranian official. The official said that Tehran had devised a response plan that would invoke an immediate counterstrike on Israel with hundreds of ballistic missiles. If you go back to October of last year, a major Iranian missile assault against Israel related to the war in Gaza inflicted limited damage, however, in part because of the United States' assistance in intercepting some of those missiles. President Trump spoke by phone on Monday with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, but the White House disclosed few details about the conversation. Trump had met on Sunday evening at Camp David with his national security team. So this seemingly has already been in the works for at least a couple of days. You can imagine that that Netanyahu on Monday spoke to President Trump and kind of gave him, you would hope, you know, we always hear all this great stuff about our phenomenal ally, our strongest ally in Israel. So if that's actually the case and that's actually true, you would hope that the Israeli prime minister would have at least clued in the president as to what was going on. And I'm sure Trump, as he had done in past years, had attempted to try and dissuade Netanyahu from moving forward. At the end of the day, it's Israel's problem to deal with. And I'll say this as we continue to look at the details. If Israel wants to strike Iran, fine. Do it yourself, and it's not the United States' problem. I don't want to pay for it. I don't want to have to send additional military aid to Israel. We already fund them. They're one of the largest receivers of military aid throughout the entire world. If Israel wants to attack Iran, that's a problem in the Middle East. Have at it. Go hog wild. I really couldn't care less. But it shouldn't be the United States' problem. If Israel wants to do this, if they want to strike Iran, whether they're striking uranium refinement facilities, other sort of research or military installations in Iran, that's their problem to deal with. It's not a U.S. issue. But my concern, my fear this morning is that Israel launches this attack, you know, could be soon as today, I guess, in the next couple of days, potentially, and then it becomes the United States' problem to deal with. We're going to have to send more money, more aid to Israel so that they can continue this. No, that's not how this is going to work. And I hope President Trump has made that clear to Benjamin Netanyahu. If he wants to go about this, if they want to attack Iran from Israeli soil, that's their problem to deal with. They're a sovereign nation. They can do whatever the hell they want. But it's not going to be the United States' problem to deal with. We are not going to be put in a position where we have to backfill aid into Israel so that they can buy more Iron Dome missile systems so that they can protect themselves from what will absolutely be a significant retaliation from Iran. You want to do that? Have at it. Leave the United States out of it. I don't want anything to do with this at all. Let them deal with it in the Middle East. Iran's defense minister raised alarms on Wednesday with a warning that in the event of a conflict following failed nuclear talks, the United States would suffer heavy losses. He told reporters, obviously translated to English, quote, America will have to leave the region because all its military bases are within our reach, and we will, without any consideration, target them in host countries. Iranian officials also balked at remarks on Tuesday by General Michael Kurla, the head of Central Command, and others about wide-ranging options for a potential strike against Iran. Iran's mission to the United Nations denounces those comments in a Wednesday social media post as militarism and something that, quote, fuels instability. The tough talks come amid a week of meetings in Vienna by the International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors. The United States, Britain, France, and Germany have submitted a resolution to the agency that would censure Iran for rapidly advancing its nuclear program and violating other commitments under a 2015 nuclear deal brokered with those countries, along with China and Russia. The board is expected to vote on the censure resolution on a meeting coming up this morning. So that could come out. But again, you know, the issue that you're dealing with here, the issue that you've got here is that Iran doesn't care. They feel like they are in a position in the Middle East where if they don't have nuclear armaments, that they are going to potentially be invaded. They're going to have to deal with constant poking and prodding of the bear. And the nuclear option is what has kept them strong to some extent and to some ability, because there's always this threat of continuing to enrich uranium and potentially giving what I'll note is the world's largest state sponsor of terror, right? Iran is not the good guys. Tehran is, they're not the good guys. They are the bad guys. They are continuing to fund the war ongoing in the Middle East between Israel and Hamas that's been playing out in the Gaza Strip. That has all been backed, a vast majority of that has been backed by Iran. They continue to fund terror cells throughout the world. They are the world's single largest state sponsor of terror. Plain and simple. There's no other way around it. There's no way to sugarcoat it. That's the practicality of the situation. They are a dangerous force to be reckoned with. No question about it. And so if Israel wants to handle it their way, which is bombing parts of Iran and then them retaliating, that's their prerogative to do so. The question is, and it appears as of right now, that talks between the United States and the world's largest state sponsor of terror have not gone very well. They're uninterested in a deal. And I get it from their element, from their standpoint. That is the last bargaining chip that they have. Their ability to enrich uranium and put that uranium into nuclear warheads is the largest bargaining chip that Iran has. And so they are going to hold on to that at absolutely all costs. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. So some censure discussion from the International Atomic Energy Agency. Who cares? I mean, it has absolutely no impact at all. So as we stand here right now, as we sit here this morning, continuing to track those details out of the Middle East, just doing a quick refresh of my social media this morning just to see if anything has happened in the last 30 minutes or so. Seems like as it stands right now, things are pretty much the same. So we'll keep an eye on those details. It could happen presumably as soon as today, if not within the next couple of days. We'll continue to track the details right here on the Nick Craig Show. Also encourage you, if you want to stay up to date with news outside of our show here live weekday mornings, give me a follow over on X. It's at Nicholas M. Craig, and tweet a mix of state, national, international news as it is relevant and breaking. Follow me over on X at Nicholas M. Craig on X. We are turning our attention this morning to some pretty big national news. President Donald Trump announcing that his administration plans to eliminate the Federal Emergency Management Agency. That's FEMA, coming up after the 2025 hurricane season. Reporters were in the Oval Office earlier this week for a briefing that the president was receiving on preparation for the 2025 Atlantic hurricane season, which, as we have talked about, began June the 1st, runs all the way till November the 30th, so runs all the way through the end of November. And the president made the announcement that he is planning for this year to be the last year of FEMA. Here's the president earlier this week.
We want to wean off of FEMA, and we want to bring it down to the state level. A little bit like education, we're moving it back to the states so the governors can handle it. That's why they're governors now. If they can't handle it, they shouldn't be governor. But these governors can handle it, and they'll work in conjunction with other governors. They'll give each other a hand. But the FEMA thing has not been a very successful experiment. Very, very expensive, and it doesn't get the job done. You saw what happened in North Carolina under the past administration. And when we got in, we did a great job for North Carolina, brought it back, but it was a disaster, FEMA. And it has not worked out well. It's extremely expensive. And again, when you have a tornado or a hurricane or you have a problem of any kind in a state, that's what you have governors for. They're supposed to fix those problems. And it's much more local, and they'll develop a system, and I think it'll be a great system. And also when it comes to forests.
So the president makes a very interesting point there about governors and states. And we've heard, and we'll get into some of the commentary from Democrat Governor Josh Stein here in North Carolina. You know, governors should be responsible for this. And, you know, when you think about that inherently, do you have an objection to that? I don't. The president makes the point, if they're incapable of handling that, maybe they shouldn't be governor. I mean, states deal with a variety of other issues solely by themselves, and there's no problem there. And yes, natural disasters, hurricanes, tornadoes, floods, major winter events, blizzards, ice storms, things of that nature, you know, they do have a huge impact. There's absolutely no argument about that. But this idea that states throughout the union cannot operate without FEMA just seems to be absurd. I feel like I'm missing part of the equation as to what I'm hearing. FEMA has an annual budget of over $20 billion, billion with a B, dollars. That money is not going away. That money is just not going to be funneled through the federal government. And the reality, I think, is pretty simple. When you have the federal government surge into an area after a natural disaster, it is not the most efficient use of resources. And those resources can be multifaceted, whether we're talking about simply cold hard cash and the ability to buy things, or the actual physical resources on the ground, right? FEMA is not the best avenue, the best tool to use these resources. We've seen that. We saw what happened with Hurricane Helene. You go all the way back to Hurricane Katrina and the issues with FEMA in New Orleans. If almost every season in Florida, you've got issues with FEMA. And then you look at a state like Florida, and you look at how quickly they recover from storms. There's the model. There's the example. Under the phenomenal leadership of Governor Ron DeSantis in Florida, they're so quick to respond to storms. It's unbelievable. You know, bridges get destroyed. Federal government says, oh, you know, that could take 6 years to rebuild or some ridiculous time frame. They've got it open within the matter of like 2 or 3 months. Power out for hundreds of thousands of people. They've got power restored within the matter of days to those folks. Right? It can be done. States are capable of dealing with natural disasters. So some of the frustration from individuals, including Governor Josh Stein, has to deal with, well, the money. The states are going to have to take this excessive burden of cost and eat it. And many states, including the state of North Carolina, we don't have hundreds of millions of extra dollars per year just sitting around for the possibility of there to be a natural disaster. But the president was asked about that, and I thought he gave a pretty solid answer in the Oval Office earlier this week.
Mr. President, how soon do you want to see FEMA eliminated? And what's your message to the governors about how much more of an expense is going to fall to states for disaster response?
Well, it's not going to be so much to states. We're going to give out less money. We're going to give it out directly. It'll be from the president's office. We'll have somebody here. Could be Homeland Security. But we're going to give it out through a method where it's given out As an example, I just gave out $71 million to a certain state. They were looking to do about 120. They were very happy with the 71 million. We did a little cutting, and they were very happy with it. So we're going to do it much differently. We think after this, Christy, I'd say after the hurricane season, we'll
start sir. You set up a FEMA council over the next couple of months. We'll be working on reforms and what FEMA will look like in the future as a different agency, as under the Department of Homeland Security, to the president's vision. And it will empower governors to go out and respond to emergency situations. And that what the president does best is to make sure that the taxpayers are only fulfilling the need to which is appropriate, and that people are responsible to respond to their own people closest to home. So
if a certain state, as an example, gets hit by a hurricane or tornado, that's what a governor, you know, a governor should be able to handle it. And frankly, if they can handle it, the aftermath, then maybe they shouldn't be governor.
And Mr. President,
and maybe they shouldn't be governor. It's hard to argue that point that's being made there by President Trump. Again, part of being a governor is dealing with issues in your state. And as the president noted, the money is still going to flow. The idea that states are going to have to burden this cost exclusively is not accurate. It's not true. FEMA as an entity will no longer exist. However, the $20+ billion a year that FEMA has will still exist. And as the president notes, they will have to spend significantly less as it relates to money, because instead of it being sucked up into FEMA and then slowly trickle down to the states, the money will come directly from the president's office. He said, you know, it could be Homeland Security, whatever agency. Well, the money will be given directly to the states. And to me, that sounds like a realistic way to deal with something like natural disasters. Because the point that Josh Stein makes, I actually agree with. The state of North Carolina and any other state does not have the extra money in their budget to deal with a potentially multi-billion dollar a year disaster or multi-billion dollar storm that hits their state. So the governor is inherently right when he makes those comments. However, as President Trump notes, that's not what's going to happen. The federal government will continue to fund disaster relief. They will just do it in a different avenue. And this comes back to one of the big pushes of this administration, to do things more efficiently and more effectively. And so you have to ask yourself the question, and I've asked myself this question, and I think I'm happy with the answer that I got. Is it more prudent for the states to have the money, or is it more prudent for the federal government to wash the money and have all the bloat that as it relates to a federal agency and then siphon it off to the states? And to me, the answer is very clear. The quicker that you can get the money to the states, the people on the ground, the people that know the geographical makeup, they know the historic elements of natural disasters, whether we're talking about floods, hurricanes, tornadoes, whatever the disaster may be, is it better to get them the money quicker? And I think the answer every single time is unequivocally yes, of course. Now, the problem that I suspect somebody like Governor Josh Stein has with this is this puts an incredible amount of pressure on the governor. This puts an incredible responsibility on the governor. And if there is an issue with relief after a natural disaster, there's no longer going to be the boogeyman in the corner to point at to blame. Right? The issue I see here is that governors like Josh Stein will no longer be able to point the finger at the federal government. They will no longer be able to point the finger at FEMA and blame them for a lackluster response to a hurricane or another natural disaster. They will have to point the finger at themselves, because they will be the ones that are solely responsible for a failure after a natural disaster. And I suspect that is part of the reason why somebody like Josh Stein is avidly against the federal government getting rid of FEMA and making it solely the responsibility of the state. That's what I believe. He doesn't want to be in the position where he doesn't have a scapegoat. And right now, the federal government's a great scapegoat. Natural disaster rolls in, it's real easy to say, those bastards up at FEMA. Those bastards in the federal government screwing us over here in North Carolina. I'm going to write a letter to Ted Budd and Tom Tillis and tell them that they need to get on FEMA's ass and get this done. That's going to go away. And that's going to mean that somebody like Governor Josh Stein is going to sink or swim based on hurricane relief. He is going to sink or swim based on the response to natural disasters. And ladies and gentlemen, I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up some of the state's horrific track record as it comes to dealing with natural disasters. You can look at NCOR, the North Carolina Office of Recovery and Resiliency. That was spawned up. It was the poster child, the baby of Governor Roy Cooper after Hurricanes Matthew and Florence, set aside to provide people the ability to have their homes rebuilt or rehabilitated by NCOR. And here we are almost a decade later, yet we still have hundreds of families that are not back in their homes from Hurricanes Matthew and Florence. NCOR, as an entity, was running a $300-plus million budget deficit just late last year. They were begging the General Assembly for more money. That's, I suspect, the large reason why somebody like Josh Stein doesn't want FEMA to go away. Doesn't want there to be more pressure on the state of North Carolina to provide this. And, you know, it's interesting. I hear, and going through, there's a great story from Teresa Opeka this morning over at CarolinaJournal.com. And the commentary from Stein is that, you know, the state is not set up to deal with this. He makes the point, quote, this is one of the reasons why it's critical to have a strong FEMA, because most states don't experience natural disasters on an annual basis the way that it feels like we do here in North Carolina. Talking about, you know, having states prepared for responses. And so the question is North Carolina ready? I mean, the state funds emergency management, the director of that, Will Ray, funds them at the tune of hundreds of tens of millions of dollars a year. So emergency management is fully funded here in North Carolina. And so if that's the case, why is there questions or concerns or potential lapses in dealing with something like a hurricane? If the budget of emergency management is what it continues to be, if they continue to have money available and they continually get funded each and every year from the state budget, which runs, you know, at this point over $40 billion, what's the issue? Why are we even having this discussion? The state of North Carolina and North Carolina Emergency Management, under the direction of Will Ray, should be capable of dealing with a hurricane. They should have a plan in place to deal with natural disasters, whether it's a flood, a hurricane, or a tornado. If not, then why the hell do we have emergency management? That's the question that is kind of burning in my head this morning. You look at all of the money that is spent under DPS given to emergency management, and then this discussion of, oh, well, we need FEMA or we're not going to be able to provide storm relief. Why? Then why the hell are we funding emergency management? Why are we spending money for the North Carolina Department of Emergency Management if they're not prepared and they're not capable of dealing with natural disasters? To me, there seems to be a huge disconnect. There seems to be a huge issue when you're agency that is solely responsible for dealing with emergencies. It's literally built into the name. If they are incapable of providing those sorts of services to the state of North Carolina, then why do we continue to fund it? Why are we dumping money into an agency if they can't do the job that is, you know, literally built right into their name? I think what the president's doing is a really solid approach and a really solid idea. We know what happens when a federal entity or a federal agency attempts to deal with a local issue. Every single time, the response is piss poor. every single time there is so much bloat and so much waste. And the reality is we have a track record. We have examples of it being done well. I mentioned Florida. Leslie commenting on our YouTube live feed this morning. She says FEMA in state will have to look more like Florida, where Ron DeSantis was on it without waiting for FEMA. Example, the Sanibel Causeway. Exactly. So states are absolutely capable of dealing with natural disasters if they want to. And that's the key question. That's the key part of this whole thing. If a state really puts its mind to dealing with the issue, they can do it. Right? I've mentioned NCOR. I mentioned Hurricanes Matthew and Florence. Those storms also severely affected South Carolina as well, right? Our neighbors were here in Wilmington. We're what, 45 minutes from the border, if that? Our neighbors in South Carolina dealt with some of the same impacts from Matthew and Florence. Guess what's not going on in South Carolina this morning? There is not an entity similar to NCOR that is running a $300 million budget. There are not hundreds of families that are still waiting to get back in their homes. That's already been solved down in South Carolina. They've already dealt with that. And it makes sense because Hurricane Matthew was 9 freaking years ago. Right? The storm didn't happen yesterday. It happened almost a decade ago. Hurricane Florence happened 8 years ago. So there is no excuse as to why things are so lackadaisical in North Carolina, except for the fact that under Governor Roy Cooper's leadership, they didn't care. Under Roy Cooper's leadership, they completely failed at their ability to provide substantial relief to residents of the state dealing with those two storms. And you know, we've got this Grow NC entity out of the Governor Stein's administration that is going to try and fix the wrongs of NCOR, try and make it so that folks in Western North Carolina don't have to wait 25 years to get back in their house whenever the hell the state gets around to it. And I would suspect that we're probably going to see a very similar setup there. I would suspect that we're going to see some of the same issues, because the reality is you can change the name of the agency. You can start a brand new agency with this guy under the auspices of we're going to correct all these wrongs. But what did we just report last week? A facility in Swannanoa, North Carolina, operating a water and shower facility at the tune of $140,000 plus a day, costing taxpayers over $20 million for one facility. That could have built over 100 homes if the state actually spent the money on, providing people relief. So the same situation is unfolding right now, and it's all happening under the leadership of Democrats in North Carolina, because this stuff is exclusively controlled out of the governor's mansion. The General Assembly has they have oversight, but they have no directive over how this thing happens. And they shouldn't. A lawmaking body should not be the ones responsible for rebuilding people's homes. What they should do is allocate the money. What they should do is allocate the funds, which is exactly what they did. They fully funded NCOR. They fully funded the North Carolina Office of Recovery and Resiliency to provide relief in Eastern North Carolina. What did NCOR do? They pissed the money away. They mismanaged the process. They overspent by the tune of $300 million and then went crying back to the General Assembly that they needed more money. It is unfortunately a cycle. It is unfortunately a story that is as old as time as it relates to government. Complete and total inefficiencies. Completely and totally being ineffective at your job, at your goal. And I hope that that doesn't repeat itself. I hope history doesn't repeat itself as it relates to relief in Western North Carolina. But I'm going to be perfectly blunt and honest with you. I don't have a lot of confidence in this Governor Stein's Grow NC entity. I don't have a lot of confidence in North Carolina Emergency Management. I don't have a lot of confidence that they're good stewards of our money. Just, again, look at that facility in Western North Carolina, providing 40 to 60 showers and bathrooms a day to people. And it cost $145,000+ a day to operate. You're telling me that's the best use of state funds? that there was no other way the state could have spent $145,000+ a day beside providing 60 to 70 showers a day. Not physical showers, right? We're not talking about 70 shower facilities. We're talking about 70 people a day. That's a gross, gross misuse of taxpayer funds. It's a gross misuse of recovery dollars that the General Assembly set aside. And I'm sure Democrats will point the finger and blame the Republican General Assembly. They've done their job. They allocated the money. Now it's upon the governor and it's upon Department of Public Safety, which is completely under his jurisdiction, and emergency management completely under his jurisdiction, and GrowNC completely under his jurisdiction to figure out how to spend the money in the most effective way. And if this report from Swannanoa out of State Auditor Dave Bolick's office is any indication, it is the same old unfortunate situation unfolding out west. So I'm in full favor of President Trump abolishing FEMA at the end of this year and pushing it back to the states. And if a governor like Josh Stein can't handle it, which he may be able to, he says he can't. If a governor like Josh Stein can't handle it, then I agree with President Trump. He has no business being in the governor's mansion. We have other governors that are capable of dealing with it. Case in point, Ron DeSantis, the state of Florida. It can be done if you want it to be done. If it's a significant enough issue, it can be dealt with. They just don't want to, because then there's no more scapegoat. There's nobody else to point a finger at. There's nobody else to blame for the failures of the state. Right now, FEMA is a great way to do that. FEMA is a phenomenal tool to use as kind of the poster boy of all of the issues. And you can say, ah, damn federal government once again. No more if this goes forward. I'm sure some of this will be contingent on what this Atlantic hurricane season looks like. If we have an incredibly destructive Atlantic hurricane season, President Trump might have to change his policy on this a little bit. The PR may not be sustainable for him. But if it's a regular run-of-the-mill Atlantic season with a couple of bad storms, but nothing so catastrophic like Helene, this is probably going to move forward. And I very much look forward to it and look forward to seeing what comes of it and really kind of turning up the heat and turning up the pressure on governors like Josh Stein to figure this thing out. At the end of the day, they're the governor. So here's the money. Figure it out. We'll continue to track details right here on the Nick Craig Show. When legal challenges arise, make sure you put your trust in the law group right here in Wilmington. Since 2003, their experienced attorneys have provided high-quality, affordable legal services across Eastern North Carolina. Whether you're in a situation where you're facing a divorce, navigating real estate transactions, or maybe you're in a position where you need a strong defense, the law group has your back. Their dedicated team ensures your questions are answered and issues are resolved promptly. Great news, they're located in downtown Wilmington and just a free phone call away at 910-251-6088. You can also visit them online at lawgroupnc.com. Give them a call, 910-251-6088, or visit them online at lawgroupnc.com. The Law Group, experience and dedication you can rely on. We appreciate the Law Group and their continued support of the Nick Craig Show. We'll continue on the other side this Thursday morning. Inflation data out yesterday paints a very bad picture for those that are wanting the economy to crash so that they can point fingers at Donald Trump and his tariff policies. We'll have those details coming up in a few minutes as the Nick Craig Show rolls on live on a Thursday morning, YouTube, Rumble, and X, and 24/7, wherever you get your podcasts. And welcome back to the Nick Craig Show, streaming live on a Thursday morning. Thanks for being here. We've got some breaking news unfolding right now as we are on the air this morning. An Air India passenger plane carrying more than 200 people crashed just moments ago after taking off from an airport in an Indian city just moments ago. Air India flight AI-171, which is a Boeing 787-8 Dreamliner. Boeing has been in the news a lot over the last couple of years for issues with some of their planes. The plane was bound for London's Gatwick Airport, crashed into a residential area 5 minutes after taking off at 1:38 p.m. local time. the Director of General Directive of the Civil Aviation out of India told the Associated Press. There were 242 passengers and crew members on board that flight, and there is some crazy video on social media of this plane barreling, seemingly falling out of the sky, barreling towards what looks to be just a regular residential neighborhood. You can see the nose is up, the tail is down, and then this massive fireball explosion taking place just moments after the video starts. That is one of the videos. Other footage from the scene shows a neighborhood completely engulfed in huge, heavy black and gray smoke arising from where this Boeing plane crashed in India just earlier this morning. 242 passengers and crew aboard. Man, I can only imagine. Let's see if we can pull up Boeing's stock price. It has got to be absolutely in the toilet this morning. It's already been rough over the last couple of months. And yeah, you can see, let's see if I can pull this up in a way that actually makes sense. You can see the stock was trading around $210 as we hit the 5 o'clock hour this morning, and it has plummeted all the way down to $197, down almost 8% with this news coming out of India. No surprise there. Boeing, man, I don't know. It's a rough situation with them. I mean, you look at the issues that they've had with the Dreamliner since its launch. You look at the issues they had with their spacecraft, which left astronauts stranded in space for months. I don't know what's going on with Boeing. I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. I have no idea what's going on with that company. It seems like everything that they touch as of late is a complete freaking disaster. And I can imagine that stock is going to continue to fall in the coming hours as we get closer to the market open at 9:30 this morning. A horrific situation unfolding in India. And of course, we'll keep an eye on those details and figure out whether this was another Boeing mechanical issue or something else that caused this plane to seemingly fall right out of the sky just hours ago in India. We'll continue to track those details and provide any new information. I'll keep an eye on the social media sphere as we wrap up the show this morning and see, just doing a quick refresh here to see if there's any new information coming in. Doesn't look like it right now, but that plane crashing, heartbreaking, pretty rough to watch. We'll keep an eye on those details. Turning our discussion this morning to inflation, right? Inflation's interesting for a variety of reasons. Of course, it makes things more expensive for you and I, right? No surprise there. But the coverage of inflation, I think, is what I find more interesting than anything else. Under the previous administration, you had huge, major, big-time problems with inflation. In the summer of 2022, you had inflation at over 9.5%, the highest that the United States had seen in decades. And while there was some coverage of it, there wasn't as much media coverage as I would have expected. I remember at the time, of course, I was doing the morning show here in Wilmington over at 980. And I was talking about it every day because it was a major, massive story. You had the economy in a complete and total free fall for months on end under Joe Biden. And the media, of course, provided extensive amounts of cover to their guy, to their party that they will go to no ends to protect. They will protect and carry water for the Democrats consistently. But since Trump has been in office and he has brought up the favorite word of his, the T word, tariff, there's of course been so much media clamoring over inflation. Now, I'm consistent. I talked about inflation under Biden. I will continue to talk about inflation under Trump. I do think there are serious concerns with the tariffs, and I have no problem expressing that opinion. But it pisses me off when I have to listen to outlets like CNN and CNBC and MSNBC and all the other major networks now, you know, pearl clutching over tariffs and how this is going to make things that you buy cost more money. And Donald Trump is going to make it more expensive for you to live your life. They didn't care about when Joe Biden's economic policies caused inflation. They didn't care when middle class consumers throughout the entire year of 2020 had inflation rates of 9%+ month after month. They didn't care at all. They're hypocrites. They want to talk about tariffs and how that's going to hurt the middle class consumers, but they didn't say a damn word when it was happening under Biden. They're hypocrites. So I found this article, and I'm specifically reading from a CNN article this morning because I think it paints an interesting picture. The headline, inflation rose less than expected last month despite Trump's tariffs. It's a pretty interesting headline. It's a surprising headline, actually, from CNN, all things considered, right? Because anytime they can get a dig in on old Donny Boy, they will absolutely do so. So let's take a look at the details. I'm going to read the CNN article almost all the way through because I think it's an interesting read. From CNN, inflation rose less than expected in May, a month when the effects of higher tariffs were starting to become more widespread. So negative framing literally within the first sentence. Even though it should be incredibly positive news, higher tariffs are starting to become more widespread. Of course. Consumer prices rose 0.1% last month, while the annual inflation rate increased to 2.4% from a four-year low of 2.3% notched in the month of April. This is according to the latest Consumer Price Index data released Wednesday by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. The better-than-expected inflation reading is welcome news for Americans worn down by the higher cost of living and who are fearful of whether tariffs will drive that higher. However, while the tariff impacts weren't prevalent in Wednesday's report, the latest CPI was lightly marked with potential indicators of price hikes and weaker consumer demand. So, of course, we've got to put a negative spin on this. We've got to make this seem like it's bad, even though inflation continues to go down. Last month was a four-year low. That should be shouted and sang from the rooftops. But it's not. Because what does it show? It shows that Trump's economic policies are having an impact. It shows that the messaging from the administration is providing confidence to the American consumer. And CNN and all these others, that they can't stand by and allow that to happen. They can't come to the reality that the previous administration's economic policy was an unmitigated freaking disaster. They just can't do it. They can't bring themselves to admit that. May's overall inflation readings came in better than expected. Economists had projected that falling gas prices would keep the overall monthly inflation rate in check, while year-ago comparisons became less favorable. Forecasts called for a 0.2 monthly rise for the CPI and for the Consumer Price Index to increase to 2.5% on an annual basis. Wednesday's report was pretty unambiguously good, said Mike Polgies, a senior economist at Wells Fargo. He's told CNN, quote, "It was a good reading in terms of looking for softer inflation. I think it's too early to draw any conclusions from whether tariffs are having X effect or Y effect," which I think is an accurate analysis. The full impact of tariffs, which I am of the mindset still that they will inherently cause higher prices for U.S. consumers, is yet to fully play out. However, at least in the short term, the inflation continues to go down. People, regular everyday Americans, are spending less for gas. They're spending less at the grocery store. They're spending less on rent. It is across the board a better situation for American consumers than it was even 6 or 8 months ago. There is no way to boil that down any other way. It's a plain, simple fact. The CPI data comes out literally every single month. You can look at a chart and see the difference. Stock market futures jumped higher after the data was released. The Dow was around 165 points higher by midday. The S&P rose 500 and the NASDAQ composite gained just almost 0.2 percentage points. CNN goes on to say, for now, a closely watched measurement of underlying inflation is holding steady. And so here's the chart, and I'm surprised CNN even bothered to include this in their report. This is the inflation chart going all the way from January of 2016 to where it is right now. And you'll notice this insane peak starting, it looks like around January of 2021. I wonder what happened there. All the way until the latter parts of 2023. So you've got this huge peak here, which was the summer of 2022, where inflation was at its highest, 9.5%. This chart is astonishing. Now, I already knew this, you already knew this, but this goes to show you the impact that inflation had and the economic policies continued to have throughout the Biden administration. And you look at where the inflation is right now, May of 2024, it is the lowest levels that it's been since the early parts of 2021. And I would suspect that that number is going to continue to go down. Now, the tariffs could potentially cause that to maybe baseline a little bit, might cause it to tick up just a slight bit, but it's down significantly from where it was, right? The 10-year average, according to this chart, is 3.2%. So we are now well below and consistently below for the last couple of months, below that 10-year average, which is good news for American consumers. Let's continue with our great piece over at CNN. Economists have anticipated that that price pressures would continue to build as businesses try and adapt to President Donald Trump's sharp escalation in U.S. tariff rates and unpredictable trade policies. However, they've also cautioned that it might take some time before higher tariff rates result in pricier items for consumers and ultimately higher inflation rates. Among the key reasons for that, economy data is lagged. There have been significant shifts in tariff policies, and some of the most aggressive duties were curtailed, paused, or lessened. Businesses front-loaded purchases, building up their pre-tariff inventory, and are offering up discounts to keep alienating customers. And some costs from the initial waves of tariffs might have been absorbed by retailers and manufacturers. Oh, so here's the problem. CNN, you can't have it both ways. You say constantly that tariffs are going to cause American consumers pain and pressure because industry is not going to eat the cost. Then you say, quote, waves of new tariffs may have been absorbed by retailers and manufacturers. So what is it? You can't play both sides. You can't choose to waffle back and forth on this issue when it fits your political narrative. Either A, the retailers and manufacturers are going to eat the cost, which I am of the opinion they won't. They either A, do that, or B, they pass it along to the consumer. Stop waffling. Pick a stance, plant the flag in the ground, and stick with it. This is why outlets like CNN struggle so much. They are so freaking inconsistent in what they do. It is constantly a bouncing ball of, well, what can we say now to make Trump look bad? What can we say now to make Republicans look terrible? It's insane. Pick a lane. If tariffs are going to be passed on to the consumers, which is what CNN has been saying for the last 4 months, then stick with that. Don't give me this bullshit about how, oh, well, you know, the tariffs may not have affected the consumers yet because they've been absorbed by the retailers and manufacturers. It doesn't make any sense. What you guys are saying is completely inconsistent. Pick a lane. I've picked a lane. Inflation is bad. I also believe that some of these overarching tariff policies are also bad. Those two things can be exclusive. Those things do not have to be mutually exclusive. But CNN can't do that. They have an inability to do such a thing. Some businesses faced with higher tariff bills have opted to raise prices immediately. This is all within the same CNN article. I mean, it's like a schizophrenic is writing this article. So are the manufacturers and retailers eating the cost or are they passing it along? Three sentences ago, they said that they were absorbing the cost. Some businesses faced with higher tariff bills have opted to raise prices immediately, while others have tried to draw out the spillover to customers. In mid-May, for example, Walmart's CEO said that the world's largest retail chain would, quote, do our best to keep our prices as low as possible, but price hikes would begin later in May. Other companies that have decided that they are going to immediately pass the cost on to consumers. The overall price hikes seen in the May CPI report were largely driven by housing-related inflation. The shelter index, which measures the cost of living in homes, rose by 0.3% for the month, but saw inflation slow to 3.99%, the lowest rate since November of 2021. Grocery and restaurant prices moved higher for the month, rising 0.3% as well. However, egg prices dropped for the second month in a row, falling by 2.7%. Service inflation was fairly muted, with economists saying it could indicate softer demand and consumer pullback. However, certain declines in categories such as airfares could be attributed to seasonal adjustment calculations made by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. In terms of calculations, it was unclear whether BLS recent reduction in collections were affecting data. Wednesday's CPI report showed very little widespread impact from higher tariffs. However, certain tariff-sensitive good industries are showing notably sharper prices. For example, appliances rose by 8% for the second month in a row, the highest monthly rate in nearly 4 years. Toy prices climbed for the second consecutive month, leaping by 1.3% from April. Sporting goods and tools showed similar price trends as well, and apparel prices also. CNN just can't make up its mind. Whoever wrote this article, let's see, scroll back up to the top, see who penned this piece. Alice Wallace over at CNN apparently is bipolar. But she is making counter arguments and counterpoints throughout the entire article. At one point, she's saying inflation hasn't fully affected the economy yet. In another vein, she's saying, oh, well, it's already affecting the economy. Look at appliances. Look at this service. Look at that service. I mean, it's just they're lost. They are completely scattered with how they deal with the issue of inflation. They're completely scattered with how they deal with the issue of the economy because they spent years ignoring it. They spent years trying to convince the American people that 9.5% inflation wasn't really that bad. CNN spent the entire Biden administration telling you as the American consumer that even though the data looks atrocious, don't worry about it. It's really not that big of an issue. Don't worry about it. It's really not that bad. And so now that inflation has come down significantly at the hands of President Donald Trump, now that tariffs have not, at least right now, caused inflation to skyrocket, they're in between a rock and a hard place because they sure as hell can't give Trump credit. But that's beyond the pale of possibilities. They can't do that. But at the same time, they want to continue to hit his tariffs and claim that that's going to destroy the middle class. So they're lost. They're a rudderless ship this morning. They don't have any ability to go one direction. They should be praising the president for lowering costs. They should be giving Trump credit for continuing to lower the rate of inflation. But they won't. They would provide cover to Joe Biden, and they did so for years, but they won't give any credit to President Trump for his economic policy. And in all likelihood, tariffs, as we continue to go down the road, as potential price impacts are seen due to these, in some cases, incredibly high rates of tariffs, will likely have an impact. But we're not there yet. So CNN has to find a way. They have to kind of bridge the gap between where we are right now and the time in which they can go, see, we told you, Orange Man's tariff policies are real bad. So that puts CNN in a rough spot this morning. Great job, Alice Wallace over at CNN. Phenomenal reporting, as always, from the Cable News Network. I'd expect nothing the less. Well, that's going to do it for a Thursday edition of The Nick Craig Show. Thanks for joining us live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, and X, 7 a.m. each and every weekday morning. And, of course, listening 24/7 via our podcast. Appreciate the Law Group in Wilmington for their support, lawgroupnc.com, or give them a call at 910-251-6088. That's going to do it. We're back with you here tomorrow morning for The Nick Craig Show.